Proteins and heat. It helps me to picture proteins as coiled threads floating around in water. This definition proves particularly useful when visualizing how temperature affects proteins. As with acid, when exposed to heat, the threads first denature or unwind and then clump together more tightly or coagulate, entrapping pockets of water to create structure in foods. Think of how heat transforms a chicken breast from flabby and watery to firm, tender, and moist when perfectly cooked. But apply too much heat and the protein clumps will continue to tighten, squeezing out the pockets of water. With its water expelled, the chicken becomes dry, stringy, and tough. This phenomenon is also apparent in scrambled eggs. Cook scrambled eggs too long or at too high a temperature and they will dry out. Put them on a plate and you'll see their poor, over-squeezed proteins continue to wring water out, leaving a puddle behind. Instead, to get the silkiest scrambled eggs, follow Alice B. Toklas's advice and cook them over very low heat. I imagine she learned a thing or two about good cooking from her adopted hometown, Paris, where she was a member of the 20th century avant-garde. Crack 4 eggs into a bowl and season them with salt and a few drops of lemon juice, whisking thoroughly to break them up. Gently melt a little butter in a saucepan over the lowest possible heat and pour in the eggs. Continue to stir with a whisk or a fork while adding 4 or more tablespoons of butter in thumb-sized pieces, letting each be absorbed before you add the next. Never stop stirring and be patient. It'll take several minutes for the eggs to start to come together. When they do, pull them from the stove in anticipation of the cooking that will continue due to residual heat. Serve with, what else? Buttered toast. A little salt can help keep proteins from drying out. Recall the many advantages of salting meat in advance. One of its luckiest consequences is that, given enough time, salt will tinker with the structure of meat proteins, reducing their capacity to expel water. Consequently, meat that has been salted early will be indescribably moist when cooked properly, and even forgive being slightly overcooked. The coiled threads in each type of protein are unique, so the range at which different proteins coagulate is vast. Preserve tender cuts of meat with careful quick cooking, generally over the intense heat of a grill, preheated frying pan, or hot oven. If cooked to an internal temperature beyond 140 degrees Fahrenheit, the proteins within tender red meats will coagulate entirely, expelling water and yielding tough, chewy, overcooked steaks and lamb chops. Chicken and turkey breasts, on the other hand, don't dry out until temperatures surpass 160 degrees Fahrenheit. Tougher cuts, rich in sinewy connective tissue, require a slightly more nuanced cooking approach to reveal their tenderness. The investment of gentle heat, time, and water implicit in braising or stewing. Heat metamorphizes collagen, the main structural protein found in animal connective tissue, into gelatin. The tough and chewy proteins that make undercooked short ribs impossible to chew and unpleasant to eat will transform into gelatin with water, time, and further cooking, yielding the rich, tender textures we associate with barbecued brisket, stewed meats, and properly cooked short ribs. And since acid will further amplify collagen's transformation into gelatin, add an acidic ingredient into the marinade, dry rub, or braise to encourage the process. The key to this transformation is gentle heat. In contrast to the carefully applied quick heat required to cook tender cuts, time and sustained low heat are essential to transforming dark meat's tough, sinewy connective tissue into luxurious gelatin, while its lumps of intermuscular fat render and baste the meat from within. Browning and flavor. Continue heating proteins in the presence of carbohydrates, and a remarkable thing happens, the Maillard reaction, heat's most significant contribution to flavor. Compare bread to toasted bread, raw to seared tuna, boiled to grilled meat or vegetables. In each case, the browned version is much richer and more delightfully complex in flavor, a result of the Maillard reaction. This transformation reorganizes aromatic compounds into entirely new flavors. In other words, in brown versions of a food, we can experience flavors that don't exist in the pale version. In the acid chapter, I describe the ways in which the Maillard reaction can produce sour flavors in a food. Any food that undergoes the Maillard reaction, brown meats, vegetables, breads, can also develop the savory aromas such as floral, onion, meaty, vegetal, chocolatey, starchy, and earthy flavors in addition to the flavors of caramelization. Because surface browning is often accompanied by dehydration and crispness, it can also lead to the contrasts in texture as well as flavor that so delight our palates. My very favorite French pastry of all time, the cannelée, is the pinnacle of this sort of juxtaposition. Its tender, custardy center is enveloped by a dark, chewy crust altered by caramelization and the Maillard reaction. Browning begins at around 230 degrees Fahrenheit, well past the boiling temperature of water and the coagulation point of proteins. Since the temperatures required to achieve this kind of tasty browning will dry out proteins, beware. Use intense heat to brown the surface of meats and quickly cook tender cuts such as steaks and chops through. After browning a tougher cut such as brisket, on the other hand, use gentle heat to keep its interior from drying out. Or do the opposite and cook it through with gentle heat. Then, once the meat is tender, increase temperatures to brown the surface. Browning is an invaluable flavoring technique, but it must be done with care. Heat that's uneven or too powerful can take food straight past golden delicious to charred. But sear a steak too timidly and you'll overcook it before it has a chance to brown. Learn to take browning fearlessly to the edge, because that's where the deepest flavors lie. Try another little experiment. Make 2 half batches of salted caramel sauce. Stop cooking 1 half when you normally would, but cook the other a few shades darker. Drizzle both side by side onto vanilla ice cream and taste to understand how much more flavor a few moments on the stove can yield. Or, next time you plan to braise short ribs or chicken legs, brown half of the meat in the dry heat of the oven and the other half on the stove to see how the different forms of heat in each method yield different results. For a hint, keep listening for the section on roasting. As with all good things, including salt, you can take browning too far. The next time you dare to call burnt bacon or nuts crisp, think of the time one of my cooks at Ecolo did so, only to spot Alice Waters seated at the bar, gingerly picking the 2 dark hazelnuts out of her salad. Having just served a culinary legend a dish he'd known was unsatisfactory, he went into the walk-in refrigerator, lay down on the floor, and cried. Though I felt terrible for him when I found out, all I could do was laugh and encourage him to learn from his mistake. Most of the time, you don't need anyone else to tell you things aren't right. Be your own Alice Waters. Temperature's effects on flavor. It's tempting to think that cooking begins with the click of the gas burner or the turn of the oven dial. It doesn't. Cooking begins much, much earlier, with the temperature of your ingredients. To begin with, the temperature, that is, the measure of heat or of its absence, of an ingredient will affect how it cooks. Food at room temperature cooks differently than food straight from the fridge. The same food will cook evenly or unevenly, quickly or slowly, depending on its temperature at the start of cooking. This is particularly true for meat, eggs, and dairy, whose temperamental proteins and fats are deeply affected by temperature swings. Take, for example, the chicken you're thinking about roasting for dinner. Slide the chicken directly from the fridge into the oven, and by the time enough heat penetrates to cook the legs through, the breast meat will have overcooked, resulting in tough, dry meat. But let the bird come to room temperature on the kitchen counter before roasting, and the bird will spend a shorter time in the oven, limiting the opportunity for overcooking. Because the chicken is so much more dense than the hot oven air, the 25-degree difference in the temperature of the bird when you start cooking it, the approximate difference between fridge and room temperature, is substantially more important than a 25-degree difference in oven temperature. You could cook a room temperature bird at 400 or 425 degrees Fahrenheit and not see much of a change in cooking time or result. If you cook a cold bird, the cooking time will increase dramatically and dry, tough breast meat will be apparent from your first bite. Let all meats, except for the thinnest cuts, come to room temperature before you cook them. The larger the roast, the earlier you can pull it out of the fridge. A rib roast should sit out for several hours, while a chicken needs only a couple. But when it comes to tempering meat, any time is better than none at all. Get in the habit of pulling out the meat you plan to cook for dinner right when you get home from work, and salting it too if you haven't already. And you'll learn that time can do some of the work of good cooking even better than the oven can. And just as cooking doesn't begin when the flame is lit, nor does it end when the flame dies out, the chemical reactions generated by heat develop momentum, and they don't stop the second you turn off the flame. Proteins in particular are susceptible to carryover, continued cooking that results from residual heat trapped within a food. Use this knowledge to your advantage, knowing that roasts carry over 5 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit on average after they are removed from heat, and that some vegetables, such as asparagus, do too, as well as fish, shellfish, and custards. Apart from affecting how food cooks, temperature also affects how it tastes. For example, some tastes, when warm, trigger pleasure responses in our brains. Many of food's most aromatic molecules are volatile, meaning that they can evaporate into the surrounding air. The more of a food's aromatic molecules we can breathe in, the more powerful our experience of its flavor will be. Other flavor molecules are liberated for us to taste as heat degrades the cell walls that confine them. By increasing their volatility, heat sets a greater number of aromatic molecules free, allowing them to permeate the environment more fully. The smell of a tray of warm chocolate chip cookies can fill a room, whereas cookie dough, still clinging to its aromatic compounds, neither smells nor tastes as compelling. Sweet, bitter, and umami tastes are more intense and send stronger signals to the brain when food is warmer. As any college student can tell you, the same pint of beer, while delicious chilled, will be unpalatably bitter at room temperature. Or try a bite of cheese straight from the fridge. It won't taste like much. Let the cheese come to room temperature. As it warms, its fat molecules relax, releasing entrapped flavor compounds. Taste the cheese again, and you'll perceive new dimensions of flavor that weren't available before. Fruits and vegetables, too, taste different at various temperatures. Volatile compounds in some fruits, such as tomatoes, are so delicate that the cold of the refrigerator can make them less available, making a good case for storing and eating them at room temperature. There's a case to be made for serving food warm or at room temperature rather than blazing hot. Researchers posit that excessive heat impairs our ability to enjoy the flavor of food. Besides burning our taste buds, hot food is harder to taste. The perception of taste decreases when a food's temperature rises beyond 95 degrees Fahrenheit. While some foods, such as many pasta dishes and fried fish, suffer if they're not served immediately after coming out of the pan, most others are more forgiving. Over the years, I've grown to prefer serving warm and room temperature food at gatherings. Try throwing a dinner party where you don't serve anything hot. Prepare marinated, roasted, or grilled vegetables, sliced roasted meats, grain, noodle, or bean salads, frittatas, and hard-cooked eggs. Besides tasting better, hosting a dinner this way is also a lot less stressful than trying to herd guests and rush a souffle to the table. The flavor of smoke. Smoke, that wispy consequence of heat, conveys a powerful flavor to food. Most of smoke's flavor is in its aroma, and it's one that triggers ancestral memories of the earliest kind of cooking, over fire. Made up of gases, water vapor, and small particles resulting from combustion, smoke is a byproduct of burning wood, which is why I always choose to grill over live fire rather than gas, even though it takes more time and effort. If all you've got is a gas grill and you want to impart some smokiness to your grilled meat and vegetables, you can use wood chips. Just soak and drain a couple of handfuls. I love the flavors of oak, almond, and fruit woods in a disposable aluminum baking pan and cover with foil. Poke several holes in the foil to allow the smoke to escape. Turn on some, but not all, of the burners. Place the pan over an unlit spot and close the lid. Begin cooking once you catch the first appetizing whiffs of smoke. Close the lid to bathe your meat and vegetables in smoky flavors, which result from a series of chemical reactions, including browning. Heat transforms the flavors of wood into the marvelous flavors of smoke, which include aromatic compounds similar to those found in vanilla and cloves. When food is exposed to smoke, it absorbs the sweet, fruity, caramel, flowery, and bready flavor compounds. You'll see, nothing else compares to the flavor of true wood smoke. Using heat. At the heart of good cooking lies good decision making, and the primary decision regarding heat is whether to cook food slowly over gentle heat or quickly over intense heat. The easiest way to determine which level of heat to apply is to consider tenderness. For some foods, the goal is creating tenderness, while for others, it's preserving innate tenderness. In general, foods that are already tender, some meats, eggs, delicate vegetables, should be cooked as little as possible to maintain their tenderness. Foods that start out tough or dry and need to be hydrated or transformed to become tender, grains and starches, tough meats, dense vegetables, will benefit from longer, more gentle cooking. Browning, whether for tender or tough foods, will often involve some form of intense heat, meaning that sometimes you have to combine cooking methods to get the different results you're after on the surface and within. For example, brown and then simmer meats in a stew, or simmer and then brown potatoes for hash to ensure browning and tenderness in both cases. A note on the oven. Baking, the most precise endeavor in the kitchen, is powered by its most imprecise source of heat, the oven. Humans have never had much control over exact oven temperatures, whether in the first ovens, which were little more than pits in the ground heated by wood fire, or in today's luxe gas-powered models. The only difference is that when ovens were still powered by live fire, no one believed that he or she could control temperature with the turn of a dial. Because, the truth is, no one can. Set the average home oven to 350 degrees Fahrenheit, and it'll heat up to about 370 degrees Fahrenheit before the heating element shuts off. Depending on how sensitive the thermostat is, the temperature might drop down to 330 degrees Fahrenheit before the heating element switches on again. Open the oven door to check on the cookies, and cool air will rush in as hot air escapes, dropping the temperature even more. Once the thermostat is triggered, the temperature will head back to 370 degrees Fahrenheit, with the cycle continuing until the cookies are done. The amount of time the oven actually spends at 350 degrees Fahrenheit is negligible. If your oven is miscalibrated, and most are, then 350 degrees Fahrenheit could mean anywhere from 300 degrees Fahrenheit to 400 degrees Fahrenheit before the heating cycle even begins. It's all mind-bogglingly imprecise. Don't let the oven's willy-nilly nature scare you. Instead, be bold. Don't rely on the oven dial. Paying attention to the sensory cues that indicate how food is cooking is far more valuable than minding an arbitrary number. I internalized this lesson the first time I worked the wood-fired spit at Ecolo. I was still a young cook when I arrived back in California, after my travels to Italy and beyond. Constantly doubting myself, I made it easy for the cooks with whom I shared the kitchen to doubt me too. None of them ever seemed insecure about working the spit, but I was terrified. What did they know that I didn't? Most nights, we roasted skewers of chickens on the spit over burning oak and almond wood. I had so many questions. How would I know where to build the fire? How would I know how much wood to add and when? How would I know if the fire was too hot or cool and when the chickens were done cooking? How could they expect me to cook anything properly on this crazy contraption when it had no controls, dials, or thermostat? Sensing my impending meltdown, the chef, Christopher Lee, took me aside and patiently explained that even though I'd never used a spit, I was prepared. Hadn't I roasted hundreds of chickens over the years? Didn't I know that it takes about 70 minutes for a chicken to roast in the oven? Didn't I know that I could tell when a chicken was cooked when the juice at the thigh ran clear when pricked? I had, and I did. He showed me how heat reflected off the walls of the rotisserie oven, just like it did in a gas oven. How it was hotter in the back and cooler in the front, just like in an oven. And to treat the birds as if I were roasting them in a big black box. Something I could do with ease. Soon, I realized that spit roasting looked a lot more complicated than it actually was, and it quickly became my favorite way to cook. Relinquish the false sense of control an oven offers, just like I did at the spit. Instead, pay attention to how your food is cooking. Is it rising, browning, setting, smoking, bubbling, burning, jiggling? When you read recipes, think of temperatures and cooking times as strong suggestions rather than fixed rules. Set your timer for a few minutes less than a recipe might suggest. Then use all of your senses to check for doneness. Always remember the qualities you seek in your food. Adjust course constantly and accordingly to achieve them. This is what good cooking looks like. Gentle heat versus intense heat. The aim of cooking with gentle heat is always the same: tenderness. Use gentle cooking methods to allow delicate foods, such as eggs, dairy, fish, and shellfish, to retain their moisture and delicate texture. Let gentle heat transform the dry and tough into the moist and tender. Choose among intense heat cooking methods, apart from boiling, which is intense in its own way, when seeking to brown food. When carefully applied to tender meats, intense cooking methods lead to brown surfaces and moist, juicy interiors. For tough meats and starchy foods, combine these methods with gentler ones in order to achieve the desired browning on the outside and allow low heat to do its gradual work within. Gentle cooking methods: simmering, coddling, and poaching. Steaming. Stewing and braising. Confit. Sweating. Bain-marie. Low heat baking and dehydrating. Slow roasting, grilling, and smoking. Intense cooking methods: blanching, boiling, and reducing. Sauteing, pan frying, and shallow and deep frying. Searing. Grilling and broiling. High heat baking. Toasting. Roasting. Cooking methods and techniques. Cooking with water. Simmering. Since the boiling point of water is such an important kitchen landmark, I'd always assumed boiling to be the most straightforward cooking method. Just drop food into a pot of bubbling water and pull it out when it's done. Then one day, after about a year in the kitchen, as I turned my 100th pot of boiling chicken stock down to a simmer, a light bulb went off. When it comes to cooking food in liquid, cooking food through at a rolling boil is the exception rather than the rule. I realized boiling is called for only when cooking vegetables, grains, and pasta, reducing sauces, and hard cooking eggs. I could bring everything else, and I mean everything, to a boil and then swiftly reduce it to a simmer to cook through, whether I was cooking over a live fire, on the stove, or in an oven. Since simmering water is gentler than boiling water, it won't jostle delicate foods so much that they fall apart, or agitate tougher foods so much that they overcook on the surface before cooking through completely. Beans, braises, paella, jasmine rice, chicken vindaloo, pozole, quinoa, stews, risotto, chili, bechamel sauce, potato gratin, tomato sauce, chicken stock, polenta, oatmeal, Thai curry. It didn't matter. This applied to everything cooked in liquid. It was a life-changing revelation. Depending on whom you ask, the temperature of simmering water can range from 180 degrees Fahrenheit to 205 degrees Fahrenheit. Look at the pot. Is it barely bubbling like a just-poured glass of your favorite sparkling water, beer, or champagne? If so, then cheers. It's simmering. Sauces. Bring tomato sauce, curry, milk gravy, and mole sauce alike to a boil. Then, turn down to a simmer to cook them through. Some sauces, such as ragu bolognese, take all day. Others, such as pan sauces or Indian butter chicken, cook far more quickly, but the process is the same. In general, keep sauces containing fresh milk at a simmer, because some of the proteins in milk can coagulate above temperatures of 180 degrees Fahrenheit, resulting in curdled, grainy sauces. Sauces made from cream contain little to no protein and avoid this risk of coagulation. And milk sauces containing flour, such as bechamel or pastry cream, are an exception to this rule, as flour will interfere with coagulation. Still, remember that the natural sugars in milk and cream are eager to scorch, so once these sauces come to a boil, reduce them to a simmer and stir often to prevent burning. Meats. I used to turn my nose up at boiled meat, which really ought to be called simmered meat, but that was before I discovered Nerbone, a sandwich stand in Florence's Mercato Centrale. The lunch lines at Nerbone were the longest in the market, so I decided to investigate. While I stood in line, I eavesdropped as everyone ahead of me in line ordered, trying to decipher their words. Even though there was a full lunch menu replete with pastas and main courses, everyone disregarded it, instead ordering panini bolliti, boiled beef sandwiches, garnished with chili oil and an herby salsa verde. When I got to the front of the line, I carefully placed my order in Italian. Un panino bollito con tutte e due le salse. A boiled beef sandwich with both sauces. Though I'd been in Italy for less than a week, I'd studied Italian intensively before arriving. I may have overestimated my grasp of the language. When the man at the counter said something to me in Tuscan dialect, I froze. I refused to admit that I had absolutely no clue what he'd just said. I nodded vehemently and paid the cashier. He handed me my sandwich, which I took outside to eat on the steps of the market. I took a bite, expecting to taste the tender, flavorful brisket I'd seen him slicing for the others. But that wasn't what I got. I was totally thrown off at first. I had no idea what was wrong with my sandwich. If this was indeed brisket, it was definitely the weirdest brisket I'd ever had. How could this strange textured, off-tasting thing be what everyone was lining up for? After a brief panic, I forced myself to continue chewing and swallow. I went back and hovered at the sandwich stand, studying the signs until I finally figured out that the man at the counter had been trying to tell me he'd sold out of brisket. All he had left was lampredotto, a Florentine specialty. With my vehement nodding, I'd signaled that I'd be fine with tripe instead of brisket. I forced myself to eat that sandwich, even though I'd never before, and have never since, enjoyed tripe. It may not have been suited to my tastes exactly, but I will say it was the most tender meat I'd ever had. The next time I returned to Nerbone, I got there early to beat the lunch rush. The brisket sandwich was the best I'd ever had. Eventually, when my language skills improved, I asked the counter guy how he got the meat so tender and moist. He looked at me bewildered. È semplice. Arrivo ogni mattina alle 6 e lo cuoco a fuoco lento. It's simple. I get here every morning at 6 and simmer it. And then he added, L'acqua non dovrebbe bollire mai. The water must never boil. He was right. There's no recipe for meat more straightforward than simmer in salted water. Such a simple preparation leaves lots of room for exotic or savory garnishes. That is its beauty. Vietnam's chicken noodle soup, pho gah, a model of clarity, is most inviting to a long list of garnishes, including scallions, mint, cilantro, chilies, and lime. Cuts of meat with lots of connective tissue, such as chicken thighs, brisket, and pork shoulder, are perfect for simmering, as the water and gentle heat will transform collagen into gelatin over time without drying the exterior. To yield the most flavorful meat, place it in boiling salted water, then turn it down to a simmer. For tasty meat and broth, start with simmering water. Add a few aromatics, half an onion, a few cloves of garlic, bay leaves, or a dried chili, and leave the slate otherwise blank. Over the course of the week, refer to the World of Flavor in the accompanying PDF and turn the meat into a different dish each night. How to know when the meat is done? It'll be falling off the bone, or if boneless, it'll be mouth-wateringly tender. Starches. Starchy carbohydrates prosper at a simmer, which rattles their tough skins and encourages water to flow inside. Simmer potatoes, beans, rice, and all manner of grains until they've absorbed enough water to be tender. As with boiled meat, heighten the flavor of any starch by simmering it in a savory cooking liquid. Cook rice in unskimmed chicken stock, as Thai cooks do for cao man gai, and you'll give a modest meal of rice, greens, and an egg a little meaty edge. When my grandparents took me on a trip into the mountains towering above their village in northern Iran, each morning I eagerly looked forward to a breakfast of halim, the hearty, nutritious porridge of wheat, oats, and turkey simmered slowly together in stock or milk, warmed me up in spite of the crisp mountain air. Porridges, including polenta, grits, and oatmeal, are variations on this theme. Simmer these starches in water, milk, or whey, the clear liquid that gathers atop yogurt, until they grow tender. Because they are so starchy, stir these dishes often to prevent scorching. Risotto, paella, and fideas react similarly. Make risotto with arborio rice, a variety with a remarkable capacity to absorb an immense amount of liquid without falling apart. After toasting the onions and browning the rice in fat, add flavorful liquids such as wine, stock, or tomatoes. As the pot simmers, the rice takes on liquid and gives off starch. The more flavorful the liquid, the more flavorful the finished dish will be. Fideas, a similar dish from Spain, is made with toasted noodles instead of rice. Paella, too, is built on the concept of a thirsty starch drinking up a flavorful stock. Traditionally, paella isn't stirred but left untouched as it cooks and is prized for the socorrat, or crisp crust of rice that forms at the bottom of the pan as a result. Pasta will also absorb flavorful liquids. As I described in the walkthrough for pasta alle vongole, one of my favorite tricks is to pull the noodles from the boiling water a minute or two early and let them finish cooking in a pan of simmering sauce. This allows the noodles and the sauce to unify into a single entity. As the pasta cooks, it gives off starch and takes on liquid. As a result, the sauce absorbs its starch and thickens, and the pasta takes on the sauce's flavor. There's nothing else like it. Vegetables. Simmer fibrous or tough vegetables, those particularly rich in cellulose, that require extended cooking to be rendered edible. Spare fennel and artichokes, and cardoons, their thistly cousins, from the tumult of boiling to keep them from falling apart. Instead, simmer them until tender with equal parts water and wine spiked with olive oil, vinegar, and aromatics to cook them a la grec. Coddling and poaching. If simmering water resembles a glass of champagne, then the water for poaching and coddling should look like a glass of champagne you poured last night, but somehow forgot to drink. The extra gentle heat of water used for coddling and poaching is perfect for delicate proteins: eggs, fish, shellfish, and tender meats. Fish poached in water, wine, olive oil, or any combination of the three will emerge with an exceptionally tender texture and clean flavor. A poached or coddled egg can turn toast, salad, or soup into a meal. Poach eggs in spicy tomato sauce and you'll have shakshuka, the popular North African dish. Use leftover marinara sauce for the endeavor and garnish with abundant Parmesan or Pecorino Romano for uova al purgatorio, the Italian version with a slightly sinister name. Either will make a fine meal at any time of day. Bain-marie. A bain-marie or water bath will help expand the narrow margin of error for cooking curds, custards, bread puddings, and soufflés, and for other delicate tasks such as melting chocolate. For these temperamental dishes, where just a few moments of neglect can mean the difference between silky and lumpy or smooth and grainy, welcome the assistance a water bath offers. Bain-marie are generally used in the oven to regulate heat. Though the oven temperature might be at 350 degrees Fahrenheit, the temperature of the bath won't exceed water's boiling point of 212 degrees Fahrenheit. But overcook a custard, or misjudge how much heat will carry over, and you'll end up with grainy pot de crème, stiff crème caramel, or cracked cheesecake. Pull custards from the oven and the water bath in anticipation of the residual heat that encourages coagulation to continue even as the egg proteins cool. I once pulled a still jiggling cheesecake from the oven. Cooling on the countertop, it looked so textbook perfect that I kept making excuses to walk by and gaze at it. When I passed through the kitchen for the 20th time, about after 4 hours, a mighty crack had suddenly appeared, signaling that I'd overcooked it. I'd underestimated the power of carryover. The jiggle hadn't been jiggly enough. To bake in a bain-marie, put a kettle on to boil while you prepare your custard base. If you have a wire rack, place it into an empty roasting pan, preferably metal, and lay the empty ramekins or cake pan atop it and fill them with custard. If you don't have a wire rack, it's fine. Just be a tad more vigilant about checking your custards for doneness. Carefully carry the pan to the oven. Working quickly, open the oven door, place the pan partway on the rack, and pour in enough boiling water to go one-third of the way up the sides of the custards. Slide the pan in, shut the oven door, and set a timer. A baked custard is generally done when a tap to the edge of the dish leaves behind a faint jiggle in its wake, but the center is no longer liquid. Upon removing them from the oven, carefully pull custards from the water. For gentle heat on the stove, use a slightly different kind of bain-marie, heated by steam rather than hot water. You don't need the whole setup known as a double boiler. You can simply place a large bowl over a pot of barely simmering water in order to gently heat eggs and dairy to room temperature for use in baking, to melt chocolate, to make certain sauces that contain egg, such as béarnaise and hollandaise, or sabayon, a classic stovetop custard. Just as the heat of a bain-marie protects custards from overcooking in the oven, it also protects them on the stove. The gentle heat of a bain-marie is also handy for keeping starchy or temperamental cooked foods, such as mashed potatoes, creamy soups, hot chocolate, and gravy warm until serving, without the risk of burning them. Stewing and braising. 20th century poet Mark Strand neatly addressed the time-flavor continuum for braised meats in his poem Pot Roast. Upon inspection of the saucy slices of braised beef on his plate, with mouth-watering anticipation he declared, "And for once, I do not regret the passage of time." Reading the poem, I know exactly how he must have felt, impatiently waiting for hours for the tender meat to emerge from the oven. Indeed, the key to any good stew or braise is the passage of time. Though investing time in cooking, or in anything, can turn some of us off from the endeavor, with braises, the investment requires little of us, but delivers big results. As my grandmother demonstrated with her flavorful horesh, it's time in braising and stewing, along with water and the implicit gentle heat, which allows for the connective tissue in the tough cuts of meat to transform into gelatin, leaving meat tender, luscious, and moist. The difference between the two methods is minor. Braises involve larger pieces of meat, often on the bone, and minimal cooking liquid, while stews are made with smaller pieces of meat cooked with chunky vegetables, typically served together in the plentiful cooking liquid. Greens, dense vegetables, stone fruits, and tofu also lend themselves well to braising. At Chez Panisse, I watched chefs buy whole animals and devise creative ways to use up all of the tough, sinewy cuts. Some we cured, others we ground into sausage, and the rest we braised and stewed. For months, I watched with awe as the cooks set out several cast iron pans to heat up over a medium-high flame, then added a splash of neutral-tasting olive oil into the pan and lay in big pieces of beef, lamb, or pork to brown. How did they keep tabs on all of the different pans, on all of the different pieces of meat? How could they turn their backs on 6 pans of cooking meat in order to peel and slice the onions, garlic, carrots, and celery for the aromatic flavor base? How did they know what temperature to set the burner or oven to, and how long to cook the meat? And when could I try? With the long lens of hindsight at my disposal, I've learned that the best thing about braces is that they're nearly impossible to ruin. If I could go back and tell my 19-year-old self to relax, I would. And then I'd walk her through the few important landmarks of setting up and cooking a braise or stew. Every cuisine around the world has devised ways to turn cartilaginous, bony, and sinewy meats into delicious braises and stews. This is true of Italian ossobuco, Japanese nikujaga, Indian lamb curry, French beef bourguignon, Mexican pork adobo, and Mr. Strand's pot roast. Use the chart of aromatic flavor bases from around the world to determine what vegetables and herbs you'd like to use, and refer to the World of Flavor in the PDF to choose your flavorings. Think of these long-cooked dishes as opportunities to layer in flavor. Every step of the way, consider how to infuse the most flavor into the dish and extract the deepest flavor out of every individual ingredient. Apply the principles of braising and stewing to any tough cut of meat. To preserve flavor, leave the meat in large pieces and on the bone when possible. And remember to season the meat in advance to let salt do its important work of flavoring from within. When it's time to cook, preheat a skillet over a medium-high flame. Pour in a thin layer of neutral-tasting oil and carefully place in the pieces of meat. Make sure none of the pieces touch to encourage steam to escape and to allow for even browning. Then do what I once found so difficult and step away. The keys to beautiful, even browning are steady heat and patience. If you move the meat around too often or just keep picking it up to check on it, it will take an absurdly long time to brown. Resist that urge and instead work on the aromatic flavor base. In a separate pan, or perhaps the same Dutch oven you plan to cook the braise, build flavor by cooking down and slightly browning your vegetables, which can be as minimal as an onion and a couple of garlic cloves if you're not feeling up for a hunt for ginger or cilantro. As the vegetables cook, check on the meat, turning the pieces and rotating the pan to get even browning. If so much fat renders from the meat that instead of searing, the meat begins to fry, remove the meat from the pan and carefully pour some of the hot fat into a metal bowl and set aside. Return the meat to the pan and continue to brown on all sides. It can take upwards of 15 minutes to properly brown a piece of beef or pork on all its sides. Do not rush this step. You want the meat to reap all of the savory benefits of the Maillard reaction. When you've finished browning the meat, dump out any remaining fat and deglaze the pan with your liquid of choice, be it stock or water. Remember, this is an ideal moment to work in a cooking acid, so consider adding some wine or beer. Use a wooden spoon and some elbow grease to get all of the tasty brown bits unstuck so you can add them into the braising pan. Build the braise with the vegetables and herbs on the bottom, then place in the meat. Here it's all right if pieces touch, as long as they all fit in a single layer, since browning isn't a concern any longer. And then add in the deglazing liquid. Top off with more water or stock to come up about a third or halfway up the meat. Any more and you'll be poaching rather than braising. Seal the pan with a lid, or parchment paper and foil, and bring everything to a boil. Then reduce to a gentle simmer. On the stove, this is simple enough. But in the oven, that means cranking the temperature up to high, 425 degrees Fahrenheit and above, and then turning it down to medium-low, 275 to 350 degrees Fahrenheit. The lower the temperature, the longer the braise will take, but the less likely the meat will dry out. If the liquid can't help but boil, flip the lid ajar or tear open the edge of the foil to encourage the temperature inside the pan to drop. Again, patience is key. But the boon is that this is passive cooking time. As long as you check on the pan from time to time to make sure the liquid remains at a slight simmer and nothing more, you can go about your day as you like. The only hustle involved in braising is setting everything up and getting it into the oven, or any source of steady or gentle heat. Once it's in, you can breathe easy. How to know when it's done? I wondered the same thing at 19 in the kitchen at Chez Panisse. But I soon learned that the meat should fall off the bone at the gentlest touch. In boneless braises, meat should be fork tender. Pull the pan from the heat and let it cool before straining the cooking liquid. Pass the solids through a food mill for a thicker sauce. and taste it and decide if you'd like to reduce it to intensify flavor before adding any salt. These techniques are ideal for preparing food in advance. Thyme performs a potent alchemy on cooked braises and stews, improving flavor with a day or two of rest. Because it liberates the cook from last-minute demands, this kind of cooking is ideal for dinner parties. Braises and stews make for excellent leftovers and freeze well too. With its basic technique, braising can be the most effortless path toward deeply flavorful food. Blanching and boiling. Blanching is boiling by another name, and the key to both is to keep the water at a boil. In the salt chapter, I described how foods need to frolic when boiled in salty waves to cook evenly. Add too much food to too little water, and a pot's temperature will drop drastically. A rolling boil will come to a rocking halt. Pasta will clump. Basmati rice for Persianish rice will stick. Pencil-thin asparagus spears will pile up on the bottom of the pot and cook unevenly. Do justice to any food you blanch and keep water at a rolling boil by using twice as much as you think you need. Vegetables. Boiling is an extraordinarily efficient cooking method, perfect for preserving the flavor of fresh vegetables. Boil vegetables long enough to let heat degrade their internal cell walls and release their sugars, and so that their starches can convert to sugars, developing sweetness. But be careful not to cook them so long that their vibrant colors begin to fade, or their cell walls break down entirely, resulting in mushy textures. Choose to boil vegetables when you're short on time, or when you're seeking clean flavors. Boil everyday vegetables such as turnips, potatoes, carrots, and broccoli, and dress them with good olive oil and flaky salt. You'll be pleasantly surprised by their pristine simplicity. While some chefs insist on chilling blanched vegetables in ice baths, I generally disagree. The less time a vegetable spends immersed in water, the less chance of its minerals and nutrients leaching out. Instead of bothering with an ice bath, simply cook your vegetables a little less, knowing that they'll continue to cook even after they're pulled from the pot. Over the years, I've found that vegetables with higher water content, like asparagus and perfect little haricot vert, carry over more than denser, less watery ones, so pull them from the pot just before they're done. Root vegetables, such as carrots and beets, won't carry over even if you beg them to, so always boil them until they are tender throughout. You can control carryover by slipping trays of vegetables plucked from boiling water straight into the fridge or onto an icy porch to chill quickly. The only way to know when a vegetable should be pulled from its blanching water is to taste it and quickly. Before you add anything to a pot of boiling water, find your sieve or spider and prepare a landing pad. Instead of piling hot veggies in a bowl, spread them out on a baking sheet lined with parchment paper to prevent overcooking. To save time in the kitchen, combine blanching with other cooking methods. Blanch tough greens like kale or collards until they are tender. Then squeeze them dry, chop them up, and sauté. In Italy, balls of blanched greens are available at every deli, ready for any mamma to take home and sauté with garlic and hot pepper. Partially blanch denser vegetables, such as cauliflower, carrots, and fennel on Sunday, and keep them on hand for the coming week, ready to reheat and brown in the pan or oven at a moment's notice. Blanching can also be a useful way to facilitate peeling produce with a clinging skin, such as fava beans, tomatoes, peppers, and peaches. Simply blanch them for about 30 seconds, or just long enough for the skin to loosen, and then plunge them into an ice bath to stop them from cooking any further. The skins will slip right off. Noodles and grains. Noodles made with wheat flour must be cooked in water at a vigorous boil in order to cook evenly, regardless of whether you call them pasta, ramen, bok mi, udon, or elbow macaroni. The pandemonium keeps the noodles moving, preventing them from sticking to one another as they release starch. Take the guesswork and measuring out of cooking whole grains such as barley, rice, farro, and quinoa by boiling them as you would pasta until they are completely tender. Drain and serve as a side dish, or spread them out to let them cool, then drizzle with olive oil and add them to soups, grain salads, or store them in the freezer for up to 2 months for future use. Once you've grown familiar with the cooking times of various foods, you can stagger multiple ingredients into a single pot of water to save yourself time and a pan. When pasta still has a few minutes of boiling left, add bite-sized florets of broccoli or cauliflower, chopped kale, or turnip greens to the water. Delicate spring peas or tiny slices of asparagus or green beans need only about 90 seconds to cook through, so add them just before draining the pot and taste to determine their doneness. Reducing. Intensify the flavor and thicken the texture of sauces, stocks, and soups by leaving them at a continuous boil. Recall that while water may evaporate, salt and other seasonings won't, so take care to avoid oversalting reductions. Season cautiously as you go to give yourself a greater margin of error. You can always adjust the salt once you're satisfied with the texture of the sauce. Extended vigorous boiling can also encourage clear sauces and soups to emulsify if they aren't properly skimmed, so take care to remove fat from sauces or stocks before you set them on the stove. Or simply pull the pan askew on the burner for a moment. As one side of the pan calms and cools, the boiling action will force all of the fat and scum to collect on the side of the pan away from the bubbles. Skim the fat with a spoon or ladle, return the pan to the center of the burner, and keep boiling. Finally, remember that reducing food will continue to cook it, deepening and changing its flavor. Increased surface area, that is, using a wider, shallower pan, will speed up reduction. If the amount of liquid you're reducing is beyond 3 inches deep, divide it into multiple shallow pans to allow steam to escape more quickly and prevent flavors from changing considerably. Using a second pan is also a great time-saving trick, and one I recently taught to a friend's mom as she struggled to get Christmas Eve dinner on the table on time. Reducing the beef stock for the sauce was taking such a long time that all of the rest of the food was growing cold. When she realized that she'd have to add 2 cups of cream to the sauce and reduce it all by half a second time, she started tearing up. Just then, I poked my head into the kitchen to see if I could help, and when I realized what the problem was, I told her not to worry. I just pulled out 2 more shallow pans, poured half of the reducing beef sauce into one, and the cream into the other, and let everything boil at full blast. 10 minutes later, our sauce was done and we were sitting down to eat. Steaming. Steam trapped in a pan, pot, or packet will efficiently cook food while preserving clarity of flavor. Though oven steaming requires a temperature of at least 450 degrees Fahrenheit, the temperature within the vessel will remain below 212 degrees Fahrenheit due to recycling water vapor. Note that since it's higher in energy than boiling water, steam will cook the surface of a food more quickly. But I've grouped it with the gentle cooking techniques because steaming physically protects delicate foods from the jostling of boiling. Steam little potatoes in the oven by placing them in a single layer in a roasting dish, seasoning with salt, and adding any aromatics. A sprig of rosemary and a few garlic cloves will do. Add just enough water to cover the bottom of the pan, and tightly seal it up with aluminum foil. Cook until the potatoes present no resistance when pierced with a knife, and then serve with flaky salt and butter, or garlicky aioli alongside hard-cooked eggs or grilled fish. My favorite steaming technique calls for a parchment paper package of fish, vegetables, mushrooms, or fruit. Upon opening the package, cartoccio in Italian or papillote in French at the table, each guest experiences a burst of aromatic steam. I once collaborated with a group of talented chefs on a special dinner. I was assigned to the dessert course. I suspect the only reason they asked was because I was the only woman in the group. It certainly wasn't because I'm a natural at pastry, where it's essential to follow recipes meticulously, and by now you know how I feel about that. While the other chefs focused on one-upping each other with complicated techniques, I took one look at the massive oven in our kitchen and decided to take another route. The Blenheim apricots from my favorite farm had just come into season. With blushing orange skin and velvety flesh, these apricots evoke both the quiet awakening of spring and the vibrancy of summer, perfectly balanced in sweetness and acidity. Absolutely delicious. If you ever see them at the farmer's market, buy as many as you can carry. That night, I halved the apricots, removed the pits, and stuffed each half with a filling made of almond paste, almonds, and the little Italian cookies called amaretti. Then I placed the apricots on a piece of parchment paper, drizzled them with a few drops of dessert wine, sprinkled them with sugar, and wrapped up the cartocci. I baked the parchment packages in the blazing hot oven for about 10 minutes until they puffed up with steam, and then rushed them to the table with bowls of whipped creme fraiche. After a refined multi-course dinner, the simple pleasure of tearing open the packets, smelling the apricots' heady perfume, and tasting their balanced, sweet tart flavor delighted our guests to no end. Even now, years later, when I bump into folks who were guests at that meal, they dreamily reminisce about the apricot cartoccio. I never cease to be amazed at how good a simple preparation can be. To steam on the stove instead of the oven, set a perforated steamer insert or sieve filled with a single layer of food, anything from vegetables and eggs to rice, tamales, and fish, over a pot of simmering water. Cover with a lid to entrap steam and cook until tender. Traditional Moroccan couscous is cooked in this way, over a water bath spiked with aromatic vegetables, herbs, and spices to lend a whisper of flavor. Stovetop steaming is also an ideal method for cooking shellfish, such as clams or mussels, in the way I described in the walkthrough recipe for pasta alle vongole. Combine steaming with the browning that comes from intense heat in a method I like to call steamy sauté. It's perfect for cooking dense vegetables such as fennel or carrots. Add a half inch of water, salt, a generous splash of olive oil or knob of butter, and aromatics into a pan filled with a single layer of vegetables, and place a lid on a jar. Simmer until the vegetables are tender, remove the lid, pour off any excess water, then turn up the heat and let the Maillard reaction commence. Cooking with fat. Confit. Confit is the French word for foods cooked slowly in fat at temperatures low enough to avoid browning. It's one of the few times you'll use fat as a cooking medium without the goal of browning. The best known, and perhaps the most delicious, confit is made with duck. This dish from Gascony, in the hills of southwest France, evolved as a way to preserve duck legs for later consumption. The process is simple, and the results couldn't be tastier. Season the legs, immerse them in rendered duck fat, and cook them gently until they are tender at the bone. You'll know the temperature is right when the duck fat emits a bubble or two every few seconds. When covered with fat and stored in the fridge, the duck will last for months, ready to be turned into the shredded duck pâté called rillettes, or cassoulet, the traditional French dish of duck, bean, and sausage, or simply heated and crisped at a moment's notice and served with boiled potatoes, zesty greens, and a glass of wine. If you don't have duck on hand, the technique works beautifully with other meats, including pork, goose, and chicken. For a holiday indulgence, remove and prepare a confit from the legs of your Thanksgiving turkey or Christmas goose. Roast the breast and offer your guests a bird prepared two ways. In the summer, try confit of fresh tuna in olive oil, spiked with a garlic clove or two, and make niçoise salad. Vegetables, too, are ripe for confits. Toss artichoke confit with pasta and some torn basil for a quick supper, or pair cherry tomato confit with fresh beans or poached eggs. Strain and refrigerate the olive oil, which will be as flavorful and valuable as what was cooked in it, to use in vinaigrette or cook with again in the coming days. Sweating. Sweating is a gentle way of cooking vegetables in minimal fat until they are tender and translucent, without resulting in browning. As they cook, they release some liquid, hence the name. Mirepoix, the aromatic combination of onions, carrots, and celery at the root of all French cooking, is typically sweated, rather than sautéed or browned, in an effort to prevent coloring. Sweat onions to add to risotto bianco, cauliflower puree, or any other ivory-colored dish where flecks of browned onions would offer unwelcome punctuation. A foundation of sweated onions is the secret to delicate-tasting single vegetable soups such as English pea, carrot, or silky sweet